to World Soccer Talk. It is the podcast. I'm your host, Nick Webster. So much to talk about today, and that's why you're probably listening to the world's greatest podcast. Well, that's what the critics aren't saying, but my wife certainly says it. The usual gang are here, including Matt Lichestarta. So let's go around and get the social media out of the way so you can be thoroughly abused like Mike Dean was today. Kartik.
I like that intro. Good job, Nick. It's at KKFLA737 on Twitter. You can friend me on Facebook also at Kartik Krishnire, or you can find me on Google Plus. Forgot about Google Plus last week. You can find me there.
Matt, I know your Tottenham Hotspur were their usual shower of crap, but you can still take the heat, can't you? Where can people find you?
It's at Matt's Musings 1. Surprisingly, that wasn't the worst performance of any of my teams today.
Nate, after last week, what have you got to say for yourself? Because that was a drubbing, and I know a certain Robin Burke can't wait to get stuck into you.
I'm forever throwing bottles, pretty bottles in the air. They fly so high, they reach the sky. And like West Ham, they'll crash and die. Suarez always biting, so I throw everywhere. I'm forever throwing bottles, pretty bottles in the air. That's what I got to say for myself.
Beautifully done. What's your Twitter?
At DarthNader99. It's going to be a real dark side show today.
And Tubby, obviously, you are still on cloud nine. Don't worry, I will bring you back to ground as soon as you open up your mouth. But where can people find you other than being drunk at the King's Head with your trousers round your ankles?
No more carrier pigeons this time. It's at Wes7ham, very original. And Nate, that was appalling, that singing. Don't ever do that again.
Yes, ever do that again.
Now I don't want to be back on the podcast anymore. That singing was really quite awful.
Awful. You can reach me at Nick Webster or on Facebook, or you can actually catch my dulcet tones on KDOC LA56 as I call Chivas USA games. Perhaps the worst team in professional football. Although you're not meant to say that. Okay, so perhaps they're not the worst team in professional football. Montreal Impact are the worst team.
Have you seen them in CONCACAF Champions League? They're actually not playing that badly.
Yeah. Well, let's get straight stuck in. There's so much to talk about, and we've got to start with the big one. Let's go to Turf Moor. No, just kidding. Manchester City against Chelsea. It was billed as a title decider. Certainly had a bit of a flavour to it, but I think it was completely ruined by that Muppet, Mike Dean. What on earth was this man thinking? 7 yellow cards, 3 for City, 4 for Chelsea, 1 red card. He wanted to make himself the centre of attraction by basically blowing his whistle every 2 seconds. And my feeling is this. If he'd brought the two captains together, if he'd brought the two coaches together, all of this nonsense could have been avoided and we could have had an excellent game of football. Instead, it was yellow card after free kick and he almost stole all 3 points from Manchester City. So we'll start with you, Kartik, because obviously you're the wannabe City fan. What were your thoughts on Mike Dean's performance?
It was stop-start in the first half. An official taking control of the match early. Small niggling fouls, getting yellow cards for both sides. I mean, this was an equal opportunity abuser with Mike Dean. We've seen Clattenburg have some shockers the last few weeks. Now Mike Dean. We're all begging to have Howard Dean back. Can you believe that? But seriously, a shocker from Mike Dean. And in the end, maybe the draw was a fair result. We'll get into that. But shocking officiating performance yet again in the Premier League.
I mean, how long is the Premier League going to allow shoddy performances by a Mike Dean? Because this is not the first time he's made a game all about himself, Nate.
Send him down to the championship. I love it. I like the idea of probationary times for referees in English football. But in regards to the match itself, it really just it's handbags in every one of these high profile games, whether it's Madrid, Barcelona in Spain, in Germany, a lot of high profile Champions League matchups. It really kills me that when we get so built up for these big head to head top of the table as their build clashes, it oftentimes ends up like this. And it's like this from Argentina to England and everywhere in between. It's just disheartening.
Yeah, but we've seen big games before where referees have allowed the game to flow. They've allowed teams to go in with some relishing challenges, but at the same time, they haven't booked everybody for the slightest infringement. And it was like Mike Dean put himself down the rabbit hole with some of his bookings, whereby he had to book the opposing team. He had to book the next foul, Bertie.
Look, stop going on about the referee. You know, sometimes, you know, referees have mares. They have bad days. You have bad days more often than not.
Never.
It's one of those situations, as Nate said. I mean, this game was built up. So when you get that sort of, the hysteria and the build-up towards the game, sometimes the referee will just not be on their game. And it was one of those games. The first half was just shocking. I mean, you know, I was just waiting for halftime to come around. That game was needing a goal. So thank God that first goal eventually did come. But, you know, I mean, it's okay. Referees have bad games. They're humans.
So, Matt, finish it up with Mike Dean. Does he deserve to stay in the Premiership, or should we start a petition immediately to get him removed?
Usually these games end up, the big games end up getting pretty cagey, so sometimes maybe a red card could actually do to add some excitement to it, and it certainly did, even though the first half was terrible. I'd actually rather go back and watch Tottenham play West Brom again after that first half, but, you know, sometimes
I would
these
rather
refs,
have
do,
my
well,
balls put in a mangler, okay, than do that.
to each their own, but referees do have bad games. It happens. Well, if the Premier League thinks he had a bad game, then send him to Bournemouth next week. He'll have those games. All of the referees will have them. When we see Manchester City play, you know, when you see Arsenal play Chelsea, you'll see a referee have a bad game. It's going to happen in these big games. I think it's commonplace at this point that you kind of just accept it.
Well, I think that's a sorry state of affairs where we're accepting secondhand goods. Okay, let's get to the game. Kartik, you know, it was in the cards. As soon as Pellegrini rolled the dice and put in a blatantly unfit and unprepared Frank Lampard, it was written that he was going to get the equalizer, wasn't it?
As our friend Martin Tyler says, sometimes it's written in the stars. It was when Lampard came on. Although I should say this exposes a little bit of City's depth. City used less players in the Premier League last season than any other club, believe it or not. The three relegated clubs used more players in Premier League play than Manchester City. Having to use Frank Lampard so regularly against Arsenal last week, he started. This week, he's the hero against Chelsea, and he's a lone player from an MLS side, nonetheless, no less. That exposes a little bit of City's central midfield depth, but what a story. What a storybook ending for Frank Lampard. That's his goodbye to Chelsea supporters. He didn't say a proper goodbye at the Bridge in the final match last year because he was still hoping for another contract at Chelsea. This was his goodbye to the faithful of Chelsea, a club he served for 13 years. I know Bertie probably feels different about it as a Hammer because he's the one guy you would always boo, the one former West Ham Academy player you would always boo when he went back to Upton Park.
Yeah, it's kind
the crazy
sad.
Thing is this, though. If he'd had more time to react to the finish, I'm sure he would have put it in row Z, but the ball came to him so quickly that just natural instinct took over, and it was a typical Lampard finish, Bertie.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's been doing this for years. I mean, he's one of the highest top scorers for Chelsea, if not the highest top scorer, and he works on instinct. He finds himself in the right places at the right times. And it was funny when that went in, because I was thinking of, Diarmi scoring against West Ham when he just joined Hull recently. And it's written in the stars sometimes. And I love the fact that the Chelsea fans were singing his name as he came onto the pitch. And they were singing for several minutes and then complete silence from the Chelsea fans, you know, once he put the ball in the back of the net. Because then they realized their worst nightmares came true.
What did we make of the little shaking chin in the post-match interviews? Was that all for show, Nate?
As far as the managers go, or as far as
he referred to City, his new team, as this club three times.
Oh, as far as Lampard goes, well, I mean, it's he's a loanee from an MLS side. I love when you actually put it in that context, Cardiff, because that is truthfully what he is. It's kind of fascinating, but no, this is a temporary thing. I mean, what desire is there to bleed sky blue? I mean, there's no allegiance to this. He's out there, you know, in the motions, and it just so happens to be that he may have scored a goal that, you know, come May could be influential in City winning the title, and I don't think he really gives two you-know-whats about it.
Well, he's on about 120 grand a week. So what do we make of Chelsea's setup then, Matt? I mean, it looked like a typical Mourinho effort. Keep it super tight at the back. Go and nick one. And it looked like it was going to happen for basically 80-odd minutes until Lampard did pop up with that equaliser. But is it just a case of, once again, Jose Mourinho being very pragmatic? Screw being entertaining. It's all about winning and getting 3 points and trophies.
It's true. I mean, this is not something that we're unaccustomed to seeing. I remember distinctly a very similar game, minus the red card, playing out last year when City host Chelsea at the Etihad Stadium. I think the difference, though, is the man who scored the goal, which was a brilliant counterattacking goal, by the way, finished by Andre Schürrle, completely caught napping by James Milner as he made the run to cross the ball into Frank Lampard. That was very interesting, as that's the one moment that separated Chelsea from 3 points, was Andre Schürrle having switching off for a couple of seconds. But there's a lot of that for Chelsea. I think they came out with Ramirez and Willian instead of Oscar, which is usually, you know, their traditional, this is how we're going to go in and pack the midfield on the road. And it's not a surprise, but again, it almost worked until Andre Schürrle switched off for a second or two, allowing James Milner, who was man of the match, by the way, what a great match for him. Is a player I like to call the utility knife player, who could play almost anywhere, gets in behind with a great cross and Lampard finishes it. But for Chelsea, I expect to see this performance almost every time they go on the road at somewhere, at some big club.
Yeah, agreed. I thought James Milner was outstanding. But the other thing that really impressed me, Kartik, was the partnership between Kompany and Malanga, being that the boys not played that much. I thought they had Diego Costa in their proverbial back pockets for the entire 90 minutes.
Yeah, Mangala was excellent. He read the game quickly. He played well even when he pushed forward. He covered space quickly, very athletic, very well positioned, good ball winner. Really impressive debut for him. And you mentioned James Milner. James Milner was spectacular today. He played five different positions during this match. He played half of the positions on the field, the outfield positions on the pitch. And he created the game equalizing goal. Amazing performance from a player that's been underappreciated by many in the British press.
So just very quickly to wrap up this game, do we still say, as I did last week and Statman concurred, Chelsea win the title? Kartik, yes or no?
Yes, they're certainly the favorite, but they're not going to run away with it. It's not over yet.
Matt?
Yeah, it's too early to say, but they're the best team in the Premier League right now.
Nate?
Nope, Leicester City wins it all.
We will get to Leicester City in just a moment. Bertie.
It's Chelsea's to lose, I think.
It's Chelsea's to lose, yeah. I mean, had they got the victory, it would have been 8 points clear of City. But they still look so solid in every single department. I mean, I thought it was a defensive masterclass. And when you think that Courtois really didn't have a save to make in the 90 minutes, it really just underlines how good Chelsea are. And staying, like we said, in Manchester, well, ha, 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 when do we stop laughing? At United's latest, I mean, I don't even know what to call this one, because it was from the sublime to the ridiculous. 3-1 up at the King Power Stadium, cruising with new signing Angel Di Maria scoring one of the goals of the season. I mean, that chip was pure wanking material, only to concede the next four as the Foxes just tore them a new one. I mean, I don't even know where to start with this, Nate, but Leicester City are not a bad team. I think we saw that on the opening day of the season against Everton. They proved that against Arsenal. This is a team that can play football. But surely, surely this is not a team that can put five past Manchester United. But then again, I guess they are.
Well, surely Manchester United aren't that quality of a side as they stand right now. And surely this wouldn't have happened against, quite frankly, most teams in the Premier League. Man United were just absolutely abysmal at the back, but we've talked about this so many times. Leicester is doing something that so many sides that have come up over the last few years have tried to do, and a couple of them off and on have been able to do it to some success, and that is come up from the lower division and play attractive football to a neutral's eye. And it's always one of those things of, it's just a ticking time bomb. When's it going to blow up? When's it going to wind down? And they're just going to get exposed for, I mean, they were exposed for three today I mean, let me
put this out there. This would not have happened to a David Moyes-led Man United team.
I was
going
to say that. I was actually going to throw that out there, that it's actually funny. As a neutral, as someone, or even as someone who hates Man United, Man United matches are going to be amazing to watch this year. Last year, it was just horrible in every way, and it was almost like you'd watch it and you'd want to enjoy it as someone with a disliking for Man United, but it was just so unattractive to watch, and it was so dead, and there was no emotion. Man United matches are going to be riveting theater this year, and they are going to be quite enjoyable for everybody except for Man United supporters.
Bertie, you know, we're English. We're 4-4-2 devotees. Van Gaal is insisting on this 3-5-2. When does he say, I can't do this anymore because these players don't get it, they're not good enough to play it? When does it happen?
Well, I think it's going to happen when he doesn't have the players anymore. I mean, because Evans is hurt. Blackett is going to be out for a couple of games. Jones is okay in the back. Smalling, I think, is just appalling in the back. His touch and his bringing the ball out is just non-existent. So I think he's probably going to get rid of it fairly soon because he's going to have to change because he doesn't have the personnel in the back to play it.
Kartik, I mean, does it get to the point where all of a sudden people start questioning Louis van Gaal himself?
Yeah, I think we might be getting to that point real quickly because they had and really appetizing fixture list to open the season.
Oh my God, it was like the cream puff of cream puffs.
Yes.
I mean, just in case people don't know, I mean, let's give them a taste of it. I mean, where did it begin? Burnley, for crying out loud. QPR, Sunderland, Swansea. I mean, it just goes on and on.
It's all three newly promoted teams within their first five fixtures. I don't remember that happening ever, actually, with a top club, getting that kind of start when Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester City, Spurs, Liverpool, they're all playing one another in that same stretch. So there was the opportunity for Van Gaal to make his mark on the league very early. These sorts of matches last season, with a few exceptions, David Moyes won. And some of these matches, David Moyes won running away. 3-0, 4-0, 4-1. These would be the matches that teased us last season, thinking Manchester United were ready to get over whatever the Fergie hangover was and push up the table. Then they would lose to Liverpool or Everton or City. But this was a shocking performance. And at what point do we start questioning Van Gaal? I think about now.
Well, Louis van Gaal said his team committed big errors. Well, no kidding, Louis. I mean, that's not too obvious. I mean, the crazy thing is he says, I've been 25 years in this profession. I've already thought that I have another experience like that with Barcelona. We were 3 goals ahead with a quarter to play. We lost 3-4. That was also with a top club. You expect to kill games off when you're winning 3-1. Well, Matt, why didn't they kill this game off? Why are they not professional enough to beat a team, a newly promoted team, when they're 3-1 up? And instead, they allowed Leicester to run complete riot, and Alloa is proving to be the bargain of the season.
I think Leicester are very interesting. As we said, they do play attractive football, but they have the continuity from last year in the championship. When you talk about who they're playing, when we look at their start, when we look at who started today, you say, aside from Cambiasso and Ulloa, all of the players pretty much started with them last year, from the goalkeeper Schmeichel to Dilak, Konchesky, almost everybody. So they're a very congruent side. They know how to play with each other. And this Manchester United side, for all of the firepower and all of the money spent, doesn't really know yet. They're still trying to get together, and this is another new back four with an academy product and a Tyler Blackett who has struggled mightily in the first couple of games. But for Manchester United, they didn't have the meaningful possession to kill the game off. It was always middling passes, allowing Leicester to poach when they had to. And again, they're giving away the penalties, as we saw. They gave away some silly ones. But then again, when they switched off, they switched off. And I also think, well, Daley Blind's a very versatile player and can play defensive midfielder as well as he could play in the back of a 3-5-2, what have you. They need some more steel in midfield. They need somebody else there to really help out and lock that down because they didn't have it. They don't have the players up front who can track back and do the work defensively. So they're caught overexposed when they go all out attack. And that back four is not good enough to defend on its own, which is why you're going to see it. And Leicester are very, very clinical finishers. They finish almost all the – they have one of the best finishing rates in the Premier League right now.
Well,
that's how it could get from – 3-1 to 5-3 pretty quickly.
To be fair, Marco Clattenburg's first penalty was a complete and utter rascal.
I mean, how
De Silva gets penalized for that, I don't know. But let's give credit to Jamie Vardy, who was just all over the park. But
with Ulloa too.
Ulloa too.
I remember how many people criticized Leicester for spending 8 million quid on him during the summer, and he's turned out to be a bargain buy. Absolutely the perfect striker for that system. Has fit in brilliantly well, is arguably one of the bargain buys right now of the Premier League. I could think of a number of clubs who would want a striker like Leonardo Ulloa right now.
The abiding memory for me from this game, though, I think was after the fourth goal when Wayne Rooney went absolutely ballistic at all his teammates. I mean, how long before we see the classic Rooney meltdown, Nate?
We kind of saw a hint of it today. I think we saw the tip of the iceberg today. And if results keep going the way that they're going, I think it's a ticking time bomb in full effect. And I love it. And maybe, just maybe, and I hate to say this, but thinking if there are any positives from that for Man United, maybe a Wayne Rooney classic time bomb blow up to all his teammates, to with Louis Van Gaal and Ryan Giggs observing it. Maybe it'll end up doing something good for the club and lighting a fire under their you-know-whats, because they need it.
Well, sometimes that's exactly what you need. And talking of ticking time bombs, I was texting back and forth with the fat man all morning while we watched West Ham versus Liverpool, and couldn't help but feel that Mario Balotelli, the fuse had been lit, and it was a miracle that he stayed on the pitch. But what a performance by West Ham United, beating Liverpool 3-1. Before we get to the good of West Ham United and you, Bertie, I want to talk to Kartik very quickly, because I think Brendan Rodgers is an overrated wanker who really fancies himself. And I think he's got Arlo White's ear as well.
Spitting fire.
When Rodgers made his tactical substitution in the 22nd minute or something, Arlo practically, you know, messed up his shorts. And I'm thinking to myself, why are we congratulating Brendan Rodgers after 20 minutes for making a tactical substitution? He's the one that's ballsed it up in the first place by playing the wrong bloody team. Kartik? Can you follow up with that? Right, where's Kartik gone? Are you making a cup of tea?
No, I'm here.
We can make you make an edit there, Nick.
But a cup of tea does sound nice about now. Brendan Rodgers, I think, is a man manager. He's a guy that manages the psychology of his players, which is why we thought he would be able to keep Balotelli in check for a long period of time. Balotelli looks ready to explode, doesn't he? It looks like, and the opponents, they know, they're baiting him, they're winding him up. I'm surprised he didn't go off yesterday, but let's think about this. Big Sam, under so much fire before the season, so much pressure from West Ham supporters, Bertie, from people who don't think he plays the right style of football. What does he do? He goes out, he gets guys who can play a more attractive style. It's working right now.
Dreamland, fat man, right? That's what you said?
Oh, my God. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, I take my hat off to Allardyce, and I don't do that very often. But what he did was he identified that Liverpool had played Champions League in the middle of the week, which is not unusual for big teams. And he went at them for the first 10 minutes. And Sacco and Downing and Valencia just made it happen. I mean, I called my son during the game, and he lives somewhere else, and I told him, I didn't recognize this West Ham team, and I haven't recognized...
Well, that's because you were drunk from the night before.
Yeah, with you. No, it's funny, because it was a very un-West Ham performance, because we actually played the ball around. Even though we only had 33%, you know, possession, you wouldn't have known that watching the game. They absolutely went to Liverpool. They took their trousers down and gave them a good spanking. And, you know, full credit to, you know, to West Ham for just sticking in there. Because when they had a 2-goal lead, I thought, uh-oh, here we go. You know, and then Sterling scored an incredible blockbuster of a goal. And then it was all hands to the pump. And it was like that through the 70th and the 80th minute. And then Amalfitano toe-poked that goal in. And I tell you, the hairs on my arms went up. And I don't remember the last time I could actually say that about West Ham. But, it, you know, you're right. It's dreamland for West Ham right now. Because I think this is the turning point. You know, Allardyce is playing a completely different game. He's got Sherwood as the attacking coach. And he knows exactly what he wants the players to do. Song, getting Song in is just a coup for the team.
Yeah, Song was complete quality. But Nate, when we look at your Liverpool team, I mean, Brendan Rodgers, he's got his new fat contract. I think it's such a typical thing that a manager has a good season, gets rewarded, and then he's completely wank.
Well, especially when you're so close to ending what's becoming a curse on the red side of Merseyside, which is something coming so close to winning the title last year. And we talked about the comparison with Roberto Martinez, too, and we'll get to Everton here later in the show with them just absolutely cocking up at home. But as far as the letdowns from last year for these managers that were so heralded, I think it's something that we've seen many times before, and I think it's on full display with Rodgers, unfortunately, right now. But another thing, too, to credit Allardyce and the electing to man mark Steven Gerrard from the get-go, that was tactically brilliant. And you also have to look back to, quite frankly, the Lambert Keane blueprint that Villa laid out for everybody who is considered a ninth place or below team when going head-to-head with Liverpool. Obviously, a City and a Chelsea, you're going to go toe-to-toe. It's going to be a boxing match. It's going to be attractive football. Not to say that West Ham didn't play any attractive football on Saturday, but the whole notion of what Lambert and Keane did last Saturday, and they have laid out something for the entire league to basically have at their disposal, and Allardyce provided his own little niches into it, but Liverpool were tactically destroyed, and you watch Brendan Rodgers waver through that entire match, and there's two ends of the spectrum. There's the stubbornness that we knew with Rafa Benitez, which it was, no, I make my decisions before the game and I refuse to change. And that ended up being the downfall of Rafa Benitez. Well, okay, there's a gray area here. And what Brendan Rodgers displayed on Saturday was the full other end of the spectrum, which to a neutral's point of view, to a pundit, to even other teams in the league, other managers, it looks like a skipper with absolutely no confidence in his own decision-making.
Liverpool and making their worst start to the Premiership in Premiership history, just by way, FYI.
Shots fired. I'll start singing again.
No. No, no.
Would you rather listen to me sing a solo album or watch Tottenham for 90 minutes, Nick?
I think I'd rather listen to you sing a song. So
love it, I win.
Where are we going to go with this Liverpool team, though? What's got to change? I mean, other than winning games, which is bloody obvious, but what has got to happen for them tactically for them to start moving up the table? Because they've played five, they've lost three games already. They hadn't lost three games until, I believe, December last year.
Correct. I think if I'm to jump in here, the rotation policy, which was what Benitez did and was the fatal flaw with Benitez at times, is now getting Rodgers. Some of his squad selections make no sense. I was shocked to see Barini on the team sheet for this match. I was shocked to see Barini dressed. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one. He's having a hard time figuring out how to integrate Lallana.
Hello, Carlton.
How to integrate Lampard. These are two excellent players. Two guys. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you dropped out there. I think you were about to say something really important, so you better repeat it.
Okay. Brendan Rodgers is repeating Rafa Benitez's mistake with his rotation policy. Now, we know Liverpool having to balance European competition this season once again like they did every year under Rafa, but we're seeing some head-scratchers. Fabio Barini in the team sheet yesterday. That shocked me. I didn't think Barini was going to dress for any Liverpool matches this season. I thought he was out the door. How about Lallana and Lambert? These two players who are so good, such quality we saw at Southampton, not really figuring out when to use them, how to use them, where to use them. And then the new players like Markovic, like Emre Can, what do you do with those guys? There seems to be some confusion about bleeding them into the squad. And then, of course, Danny Sturridge is injured, and we see the limitations in Liverpool's attack. So there are a lot of problems. I think Rodgers figures it out, but maybe it's too late to make a title run for him to figure it out. Let's hope they can finish in the top four.
Too late for a title run. In almost the exact same scenario Spurs found themselves in last year. Lots and lots of money to spend after the Gareth Bale selling off to Real Madrid. And what did they do with the money? They completely wasted it, had a shocking season. Liverpool doing exactly the same thing again. Matt, what is going on at Spurs? Because if it wasn't Pochettino and that was Tim Sherwood in charge, they would be calling for his head right now.
Well, what I'm going to say about this happens in every Tottenham. Last week was the definition of what Spurs fans call Spursy, which it doesn't matter how well they play, it doesn't matter who the manager is, those games will always happen because it's Tottenham Hotspur and we can't have nice things. This was another one of those games where I'm going to now officially denote West Brom as Tottenham's bogey team after the last three matches, which made no sense to me, considering how awful West Brom looked at many points this year, although I have to give Alan Irvin credit. Got the tactical decision brilliantly right today, setting up in the two banks of four and having Sessegnon and Berahino up top. For Pochettino, it was more sticking with what worked in the league. It makes sense. I can understand why he did it. They played very well against Sunderland, should not have drawn that game, and they did. You could argue they were unfortunate to draw the game, but they played really well on the road against a team they should have beaten, and they played attractive football today. It was a lot of the traps that they had at home under Andre Villas-Boas as they played. They tried to be a little bit too fancy. They didn't have the width necessary to break a team down like that. And I think a lot of that, even though I slag off on Andros Townsend a lot, and I did especially watching the game against Partizan on Thursday, not having him here definitely limited what Tottenham could do. They needed his width. They needed his ability to cross the ball, to get the speed in behind, to really make the West Brom fullbacks nervous. It was too deliberate. It was a lot. It was a little slow. I also want to say, can we please not have Yunus Kabul and Vlad Kirakesh as the center back pairing? That's not going to work. But, and especially Kirakesh, who had an awful game today. Saito Berahino was torturing him all day. But for Spurs, I'm not surprised that these games happen. I think it will. Maybe it happens because I think Pochettino was a little bit too averse to change when what he was doing was working. Because it did work against Sunderland, let's be honest. But I think the good thing is it will force him to say, all right, we have to change something up tactically. We were a little too narrow. We were too deliberate. Going to the Emirates next Saturday, he has to make some tactical changes. I think you'll see them. And I think that's a good thing because I think Mauricio Pochettino is a manager willing to stick with what works instead of really tinkering based on the matchup, which is something I'd like to see from him more. But now, knowing that this huge game for him next week is coming up, I think he's going to make some tactical decisions. You're still going to see it broadly the same system, but I think some new players are going to be introduced. You might see Stambouli. You'll probably see, I think, Andros Townsend, at least on the bench. He might even start. We might see a change at striker. We should see center back changes. I think the changes that come from a game like this are good, but it's definitely frustrating. But the other positive for me is that everyone agreed that this game was awful and that the part of the onus was on Pochettino getting it wrong.
Yeah, but
the problem
with Spurs, honestly, if you ask me, and I've watched them for more years than I care to remember, is that when things aren't going well at White Hart Lane, that crowd turns simply poisonous. All right, they do not get behind their team when it's not going well. You know what? Spurs, when they're on song, the White Hart Lane crowd is spine tingling. It's one of the best atmospheres in football. But they do not get behind their team when it's going poorly. And until that changes, Tottenham are going to lose these games because they consistently lose them year after year.
I don't think it's all the crowd. I think the crowd are a little bit jaded. This was not as bad as it was last year.
How can you be jaded? You've not won anything in 50 bloody years.
You're jaded from these bad games where you can't really get mad at them anymore. That was my expression. I think they've seen too many of them in the last couple of years. I mean, I could name three or four of them.
Where does this sense of entitlement come from? It's one of the most dashed clubs in the history of the English footballing league. I mean, you're talking about a side that has won absolutely nothing. Where does it's the same thing with Newcastle supporters as one of the most feeble-minded group of individuals that will so quickly turn on their team. And I hear all this explanation for it. Where does the sense of entitlement come from?
They're just a bunch of monkeys, I'm telling you. Northern monkeys,
you might not
southern
want to describe
monkeys,
a group of fans
monkeys.
As monkeys. I wouldn't do that if I was you.
Matt, have you ever seen the movie Animal House? If you have, there's a great, great line where John Belushi looks at Flounder and he says, "My advice to you, start drinking heavily."
I planned on that and realized I had an NFL game with my team at 1 o'clock where I realized it would probably be better suited to drinking.
Matt,
half,
this is an NFL free zone. Do not mention the NFL on this podcast.
Neither here nor there. But anyway, the point is, for Tottenham supporters, I can understand why they'd be mad. These are incredibly frustrating games to watch, especially against teams that they should beat. And sometimes there's a segment of fans that are way too toxic with the players and are always looking for something to moan at. And
yeah, there's about 35,000 of them.
There are many, many more of them that are realistic after the day. I was talking to a couple of them, and I understand that you can get mad at these games, and I understand that Pochettino got it wrong, and he did, but he admitted it. These games are going to happen. And bad performances are going to happen. I'm not going to get – if they keep chaining up and they keep happening, that's when there's a problem. But if from 1 week they play
incredibly good – But they do keep happening. The last time you played at home in the league, Liverpool absolutely destroyed you.
They're both for similar reasons, but I think they're different results.
Liverpool similar reasons because the team's absolutely a joke.
So Liverpool were a joke on Saturday. Calm down about your jokes here, mate.
Who invited Andy Dick on the show?
Can we move on, please?
Can we move on? Ladies. All right, Pochettino. I guess he lost the season, but I'll go to the voice of reason, Kartik. We know how poisonous these Spurs people are. We know that Daniel Levy has the patience of a wasp on speed.
You guys
right?
do too. It's very funny how that works.
Daniel Levy has the patience of a wasp on speed. How long does he stick with Pochettino?
It could be even worse. Isn't Mike Ashley a Spurs fan? He could actually be running your club.
Well, that's true. I'm much more happy with Daniel Levy than Mike Ashley, I'll say that. Sorry, Rangers.
They're polar opposites as far as their – well, the sense of entitlement among Spurs supporters and Newcastle supporters exactly the same, but the owners are different. Let's put it this way. Levy, he has a short fuse. He has a quick trigger. Pochettino, who I think is a good manager, but he's inherited a load of crap, overspent the last summer in the bail money, and he has to mold the squad out of that. He's not going to be given the time. You know that. He'll be gone by the end of the season unless
I'm not sure about that. See, Daniel Levy has more issues with Archway Steel than he does with Mauricio Pochettino right now.
At halftime of a match in Europe, they had finished fifth consecutive seasons. They didn't make the Champions League 1 year because of food poisoning. Remember that? He stopped them at halftime. He's a horrible owner.
I agree with you.
Apparently, they're about to be sold to an American investment firm.
And this American investment group... here's a news flash, and please don't repeat this because I'm not meant to tell anybody, but the same people who bought the Dodgers are going to buy Spurs.
Quite the same people they were involved with. Weren't they involved with Guggenheim?
And Spurs are going to play at either Wembley Stadium or the Olympic Stadium for the year they're away from White Hart Lane. But let's wrap up Spurs because I want to get something.
If correctly, Nick, you were broadcasting that game where Yul was sat. On Fox. Yeah. I think you were.
I think
that's
so.
What I think about it.
that was pretty brutal as well. The 4-4 tie against Aston Villa. One of the games of the season. All right, that's wrapping that up. Pochettino's out, Levy's done, and Spurs are a complete joke. But talking of jokes and talking of overrated, and this one is especially for Kartik, Matt, and Nate, Tim Howard, what a complete and utter numpty. I mean, this is a man that needs to concentrate on being a bloody goalkeeper instead of being a wannabe commentator. Because right now, he is the major problem for Everton and one of the reasons why they are on the wrong end of the table. Nate, Tim Howard, overrated.
I'm not going to argue, actually. He absolutely is overrated, and he's slightly overrated as a commentator as well. Hopefully that'll get some work on it if he's trying to keep on with that for years to come. But what really kills me is I actually got to watch in entirety the 4-1 victory against Wolfsburg in the Europa League on Thursday, and it was as if I was watching prime 2005, 2006 Tim Howard just in his absolute young, exuberant way, and it was so great. I'm thinking, all right, he's finally – Timmy's focused on football. Timmy is back in the groove. He is between the pipes and nothing is getting through him that is not of the highest quality. And then this weekend happens.
He's been smoking the pipe, not between the pipes, right?
Which kind of pipe? The crack pipe or the Northern California pipe?
I have no idea. But I mean, for a player who's meant to be at the height of his powers, errors that he made yesterday in that loss to Crystal Palace are quite stunning. And, you know, the goalkeeper, I've always said to any team I coach, the goalkeeper is the most important player on the team because they can kill a team with a simple mistake. And Tim Howard is doing that, Kartik.
He certainly is, and I have to go back and say, and I took so much abuse for it a year, year and a half ago, 2 years ago. Matt, you remember this. You were on the show in those days. When I said Timmy Howard should not be the USA number one, I thought Joel Robles was a good signing for Roberto Martinez, bringing him over from Wigan, and I thought he would start ahead of Tim Howard last summer. But Timmy Howard had a good season. He, I guess having some competition at Everton improved him, because the final two seasons under Moyes, he was rubbish. And Moyes was going to bring in another keeper that summer had he not gone to Manchester United. So he had a good little run. He reestablished himself as a top keeper in the Premier League. He had a great World Cup, but I still have seen so many poor decisions from him over the course of, let's say, the last four or five seasons in English football, and also somewhat with the national team. He doesn't read crosses well. He's indecisive. He doesn't communicate with his back line as well as the top keepers in the world. And Jagielka and Distan, both of whom are very accomplished center backs in this league, are a mess right now. And I think a lot of it goes through Tim Howard. He's not communicating well. He's not being decisive. He doesn't read crosses well. Sometimes he's reckless coming off his line. A lot of problems right now for him.
Well, thankfully for you septics, he's put himself on another Landon Donovan type sabbatical for a year. But Nate,
well, he's not going to Cambodia. He just wants to see his family in Memphis.
Same thing, basically.
Memphis and Cambodia are two very, very different places.
Well,
that's debatable.
If we're going to get really technical about it, yes, they are in different places. But, you know, Tim Howard, if he was in Cambodia, wouldn't make much difference with his goalkeeping performance as of late. So, Nate, what does Martinez do with this guy? I mean, at some point, he's got to think about benching him.
I think it may happen. I think the way that we'll see that in a Premier League match is if, in a cup competition, someone else comes in and has a fantastic game behind him, and then there's some chirping around the circles. But I also have to go back to the fact that Everton Football Club have more loyalty to American players than Bruce Arena or Jurgen Klinsmann or Bob Bradley. I mean, we're talking Landon Donovan, Joe Max Moore, Brian McBride, and now Tim Howard. They love the Yanks. They chant USA at Goodison like you were in the south of this country. It is absolutely fascinating. I don't see Howard getting benched unless someone else comes in and has a stunning game that just electrifies the crowd, stunning diving saves that then say, hey, well, what about throwing him in instead of Timmy during the weekend?
Yeah, well, let's talk about the team that gave him a walloping. And Neil Warnock, I mean, I know he's a favorite of Bertie and of mine. And if you ever get a chance, you've got to go to YouTube, type in Neil Warnock halftime rant, because he is good value for money. Right, Bertie?
Yeah, he is. He's a really extraordinary manager, actually. He's done well, actually. He's undefeated, right, in his first three games. He's won a game and drawn two. I mean, I don't know what it is about him, because he plays a very basic game. But, you know, I just think Everton are just having a hard time right now. And as far as Tim Howard is concerned, you know, every goalkeeper has a blip. And he's going through that right now. It's the same with Joe Hart. He had a problem. So Everton will be fine because they're playing the right brand of football. But Crystal Palace, yeah, credit to them. I mean, they're there. I mean, they're competing. They're not a very attractive team, but they will probably stay up with them, just like they did with Pulis. You know, they're one of those dogged teams. There's nothing attractive about them, but, you know, they're getting results.
Well, many said that Palace were favourites for the drop after losing Tony Pulis on the eve of the season. I mean, Matt, do you think they're still relegation candidates, or is there something in this team?
Well, there's something in it, but I think they're still relegation candidates. I love the play that they can have players like Yannick Bolasie, who's a nice, a tricky winger who could come in and do some things creatively on the wing. And they have a player like Mile Jedinak, who's got all of the steel and grit in midfield, I like. And they can have strikers. Shamak on his day, Dwight Gale can do some good things. I think the signing of James McArthur was a good one, and it's definitely helped them out. Fixing a few of the issues that they might have had sans Pulis, and they definitely have issues. They're not going to be, I think, a team like Leicester, who's, I think, can separate themselves by having just a distinct little bit more quality than Palace do, but they're going to be in a relegation fight. I don't know right now whether they're going to be favorites. I think there are some teams that are playing worse than they are right now, obviously, but they're going to be around, and I think they're going to have some issues, but they'll definitely have a chance to stay up. And one thing on Everton, this is a team that was almost pretty much unchanged from the Europa League Thursday games Now, the fact for Everton is their first game in the Europa League was a home game against Wolfsburg. Their next one's a trip to Russia. You can't really put out an unchanged side when you're traveling to Russia and then coming back for a Premier League game on Sunday. That is going to be very interesting to see how Martinez manages the squad, which I don't think is really that deep. And if he can't balance that well, it's going to hurt Everton in both the league and in the Europa League.
Let's move off to Turf Moor. We're going to have one comment on this because it's hardly worth talking about. We'll go to Kartik because you probably have the stat at hand. How long has it been since Burnley scored? Kartik, where's he go?
How long has it been since Kartik has spoken?
Does he keep on making cups of tea or something?
No, I just keep putting myself on mute. First match against Chelsea, remember? Turf Moor's alive. Chelsea, the title favorites, come in. They score almost immediately. I think first 20 minutes. I don't think they've scored since.
They so that would have be been
four games. So who's four. Good at math? 360 minutes plus another seven. So 70. Probably like
70. So 65 or so. So that would be... Yeah,
425 minutes.
Wow.
Oh dear, Sunderland.
They haven't conceded many.
What can you say about Sunderland, Kartik? Other than Gus Poyet, your man crush, right?
Oh, they're terrible. I mean, they didn't do what they needed to do this summer. Van Aanholt's been a nice addition at left back. He almost scored a goal actually in stoppage time. But other than that, goodness, Sunderland's going to be in a relegation fight yet again this season. They're too big a club to be in this mode every season, it seems. But I don't see anything from them that makes me think they can get out of it. And the guy who helped get them out last year was Fabio Barini. We already talked about him. He's not playing for them this year.
Staying Kartik, you're such a glasses-half-full kind of guy. Burnley have allowed four goals. The only other team to allow less is Southampton. Glasses-half-full. Burnley are staying up. Turf Moor's alive. Love it.
Oh, Jesus Christ. What a load of rubbish. Okay, let's stay in the Northeast. Bertie, your little man crush, because he used to be a Hammer manager, Alan Pardew. I love it before the game. You know, he's got 45,000 people just dying to hurl abuse at him. So he gets into his little coaching area, stands there, looks around, gives them all a little clap, and then proceeds to see his team go down 2-0 before mounting quite an impressive comeback. Mike Ashley has said that he will not fire Alan Pardew. I mean, is this some kind of sick joke that Geordies don't get?
Yeah, so that's the kiss of death, isn't it? Because he's got the approval from...
Ashley's a complete and utter moron. I mean, how the guy became a multi-millionaire or billionaire, I have no idea, because if you look at him, I mean, Forrest Gump has more intelligence.
He made his money on being ruthless. He also made his money on being very clever with how to make money. And that's what he's doing with Newcastle. He's buying and selling, and he's making money for himself. But the fact is that, you know, the fans have turned on him now because, you know, they have this, you know, this right that they feel that they should be a big club.
Sense of entitlement, get it right.
Exactly. But, you know, I mean, it's a toxic environment right now. I mean, the journalists, I mean, you know, they're banning journalists from there. And, you know, they have an owner that never speaks to the media. They don't seem to have a plan. You know, I mean, they're on 3 points, they're at the bottom, and there's a reason for that. But, you know, for the time being, he keeps his job. But, you know, if it wasn't for Cisse bailing him out at the end, it would have got really, really ugly. And, you know, I don't blame him because I think they're playing really bad football. And, you know, they deserve everything they get right now. But I think Pardew's a good manager. It's just that, you know, he doesn't have the support of an owner that comes out and says, I'm going to support him, apart from when he says, oh, yeah, his job is safe. That's fine. But, you know, I mean, they need to be talking. They need to have a plan. And there is absolutely no plan right now.
I think he supported him decently. He signed some pretty good players for them this summer. Now,
he has nothing to do with the signings, though.
Well, no, he sanctioned the money. They've spent some money this summer.
But they didn't. Previous two windows. They didn't spend a single quid the previous two windows.
That's when I would criticize Mike Ashley when he didn't sanction money and they sold Johan Kabay and had no replacement. They bought players in this window that I really like. Obviously, Jan-Mat Kabay. Some of these players, I think they're not flourishing because Alan Pardew needs to be sacked. That's part of it. I think it's time when a manager runs his course, you can see it. There are too many good players in that side. Too many players that are not world-class, but are very talented players who have done a lot well in the World Cup. You saw players like Jan-Mat Kabay is a very talented player. We've seen with Montpellier. They need a new manager to help unlock that. And Mike Ashley's not willing to sack him, and that's a problem. because he knows with Pardew. Hold on, Kartik. He knows with Pardew they're going to stay up. He knows they're going to stay up, but they can't do much more than that. And Newcastle fans, as we talked about before, they expect a lot. So just barely staying up is not good enough for them.
Bertie, but you said they're starting to ban journos. Have they banned us yet?
Well, it's only a matter of time, Nate. If you carry on singing like that.
Oh, it's going to happen. Oh, get a few drinks with me. It's going to happen.
But guys, Newcastle has always underachieved. I mean, Freddie Sheppard ran the club into the ground as the owner before Mike Ashley, and they would always have players that achieve great things at other clubs go to Newcastle and flop. This has been going on for 20 years. Well, it's been going on since Kevin Keegan left the first time. It's been going on for 15 years since Kenny Dalglish took over. This is nothing different. I don't know why Newcastle supporters are so hostile towards Pardew when they've had, Kenny Dalglish, the legend, King Kenny, he trashed the club. Sir Bobby did well, but Rude Hoolett was terrible. Glenn Roeder, who was a decent manager elsewhere, was terrible there. Give Pardew a break.
Alan Pardew, if he were a bar of chocolate, he'd eat himself.
He'd eat himself.
That's right. Okay, so we think that Pardew's a complete Muppet, but what about this Hull City team with Steve Bruce refusing to be drawn on the question of whether he's going to be Newcastle's next manager? Steve Bruce, a proper Geordie at heart, has turned this Hull City team into, I think, and I'm going to say it out loud, everybody's favourite second team. They play some lovely football. They seem to really go for it on every occasion. And in all honesty, I think that they are one of the surprise packages of the Premier League so far this season. Bertie.
Oh, me? Okay. Because
I know you know bugger all about Hull, and Jesus, you're going to completely lie your way through this.
No. Steve Bruce is a good manager. He was really unfortunate when they lost to Arsenal, and I was at the Cannes Film Festival watching it in a pub, and I couldn't believe what was unfolding. What, they went 2-0 up, right? And then the space of, you know, the next 45 minutes, they just completely capitulated. But no, he's playing some good football. He could probably be the next Newcastle manager. But, you know, yeah, they're playing in the right way. But they're also fortunate the fact that Newcastle are just, you know, going the wrong way. And so playing them at this moment in time, you know, was an easy thing for Bruce. So he feels bad because he drew with West Ham during the middle of the week, 2-2, where they were leading that game. They were leading this game by 2 goals, and they basically threw it away. And, you know, I was very surprised that Newcastle came back in, but that's what I love about the Premier League. It just keeps on giving all the time. And who knew that, you know, Cisse would just do what he did and just bail out Pardew? Pardew's a lucky man, but, you know, how long he'll stay in his job, I have no idea. But Steve Bruce, he's a good manager.
Premier League is the best league in the world after this weekend. No two ways about that. I can't see anybody arguing. Yes, Nate.
I just want to know, I mean, are you practicing Bakra yoga and eating kale now? You were watching your football at the Cannes Film Festival?
Look, sometimes you have to go to those places, all right? And, you know, I just happen to go to Cannes, that's all.
All right, talking of a...
I'm not attacking you. I'm quite impressed.
Talking of a team going in the wrong direction, Swansea. High-flying 2 weeks ago, well, they ran into Chelsea, and now they've run into this Southampton team. Has the bubble burst, Kartik, on the Swansea side? Have they been found out for what they are, which is just a small provincial team?
Well, they're a little better than a small provincial team. Then again, we had a small provincial team, Nottingham Forest, win Europe twice. But, yeah, they were punching above their weight. Nate, go ahead.
Oh, I was saying good history, that's all.
Okay. Nate just wants to talk about bouncing on falsies, that's all.
And kissing my missus with a pickled onion, indeed.
But they were punching well above their weight, and I think the thing we're going to find as the season wears on is that Swansea is now not keeping the ball as well as they did previous seasons. And that's going to expose them at times at home. The Liberty was such a fortress, but they might be able to steal matches away from home as they did at Manchester United. That's not something they did in previous seasons. So it's a different type of Swansea team under Gary Monk. They'll have these blips at home at the Liberty, but they'll also steal some points away from home because they're more pragmatic in their approach than they've been than they have in past seasons.
Matt, Ronald Koeman could have been, should have been the Tottenham manager. Once again, Daniel Levy making a huge ricket going with Pochettino. Well, he's coming in and he's really done miracles with this Saints team, who were basically gutted by every other Premier League team. What is going on with Koeman? How is he getting these results? How is he getting Southampton to play with such flair and panache?
Well, there's a bit of a system there, kind of like how there is at Swansea. There's a bit of a system that was left over from Pochettino. So a lot of these players are understanding, and there's not really much difference tactically from Koeman to from Pochettino to Koeman. I think part of it today had Wilfred Bony losing his head a bit and getting a silly yellow card, a second yellow at the end of the first half. And that allowed Southampton to really play the kind of football that we can expect. But they see some of the signings have made sense. Graziano Pella, great signing in Dutch football. There's always that chance when you sign somebody from the Dutch league that it could go horribly wrong or it could be a smashing success. And right now, Pella's playing pretty well. You've seen the stepping up of players like Morgan Schneiderlin, who's played immense in the first couple of games. Victor Wanyama, who had injury problems last year, but we knew he had the ability to be a good lockdown midfielder. He's played very well for Southampton so far. I think they've gotten good help in defense. Ryan Bertrand, even though he's kind of been handed off from club to club, you think he's playing pretty well. They've signed a good goalkeeper in Fraser Forster. They've got a few of the academy holdovers from the last couple of seasons. I think they're a very good side, and they certainly were not relegation fodder, which some people thought. I didn't think that they were going to be that in that dire of trouble. I rated Ronald Koeman as a manager and some of the players they brought in. But yeah, I've been impressed with Southampton, and I don't think Swansea are going to be as bad. As Kartik said, they've given up a little bit of the possession for a little more pragmatism, which is okay. Idealistic football kind of got Michael Laudrup in trouble last year. But I think both of these teams are very interesting. And Southampton, again, they could be a club that challenges up close to that top seven of the clubs that, you know, we always assume are going to finish there. But Southampton could possibly break into it. They're continuing to play some very good football, and they don't look like they've missed a beat from the changing of manager and the addition of a bunch of new players. I have to give a lot of credit to Ralf Kruger, who has done a very good job as the new chairman at Southampton. I have to give him a ton of credit for that.
Well, let's talk about a team that is relegation fodder, Queen's Park Rangers, as they certainly got out of jail against my boy Peter Crouch. And I'm absolutely gutted because I had Crouchy on the fantasy team, and what did I do on Friday? I made him a sub. Oh, an assist and a goal by the big man Crouchy, but Nico Crankart bells QPR out. QPR, Bertie, they've spent a lot of money, and Tony Fernandez, when is he going to pull the plug on this little project? Because it doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere.
Well, he's probably going to have the carpet pulled away from him in December when they've been spending way too much money beyond the payroll. And so, you know, when you play in the championship, there's a certain amount of loss that you can take. You can only take about, I think it's like
£5 million, something
yeah,
like that.
It's eight or five. Well, it's eight if the owner puts money into it. It's $3 million if the owner's not putting money into it. But it's the same thing for, you know, for Reading and for Wigan. They could be in trouble. And the problem is when you go down and you get relegated, you know, granted, you've got the parachute payments and all of that from the TV money. But, you know, all of those teams lost players, you know. So and the fact that QPR came straight back up is an absolute miracle, you know, based on, the, you know, because they had to
They could have been in some very, very serious trouble if they had stayed. If they didn't win that game against Derby, they could have been in very serious trouble. We might have lost a club if that happened.
Well, I think they're still in trouble, you know, because
They are, but not as much as they would have been, I think.
Well, you never know, but I think Fernandez, you know, he should just stick to Formula One because, you know, he has no idea how to run a club in the Premier League. He doesn't understand, you know, the mechanics of what goes on and how players are brought in and how they're sold and everything else. But no, I think QPR look like they're going down, them and Burnley. And if QPR goes down again, they are going to be an absolute mess. Because you have to remember, they only play in front of 18,000 people. So, you know, the fair play, you know, the financial fair play comes into play where it's all about the revenue you make and it's all about the expenses. And so they've been spending so much money on players way beyond their means that it's not going to look good. You know,
QPR
there are actually some reports out there, Bertie, that the Football League may not accept QPR if they are relegated because of their financial situation and their overspending. They may have to go to the conference. I don't know how it would work, but that's out there.
Well, look, we've seen it with Portsmouth, who won the FA Cup in 2008, and look where they are now. If you spend beyond your means, you will get punished. Saving the very best till last.
There's a link to that, there's a link to that, Nick. A certain manager.
A certain manager, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Well, best left unsaid, because we're going to save the best till last. And I'm talking about the best 3 minutes. And I'm not talking about what happened last night with me and the missus, all right? It was Arsenal and Villa Park. What a stunning turnaround. Kieran Clarke had the chance to put Aston Villa ahead. Not quite sure how he didn't score with that header. Let's give Chesney all the credit in the world. But then Arsenal suddenly found this switch that flicked into overdrive, and they looked like world beaters, Nate. I mean, this was a stunning 3 minute display by Arsenal, and can we expect to see more of it?
Why not? We always talk about that killer instinct, that final desire to close something and not be satisfied with the one that, and you make all the boxing analogies in the world, and this had that feel of one of those moments where they had Villa trapped in the corner on the ropes, and now was the time. It was absolutely beautiful to watch. It was something unlike anything we've seen from them so far this season, and from an optimistic point of view, why not expect more of it? We've seen it. We've seen that they can do it against a team that we talked about last week that has this already a reputation around the country as this dogged, gritty kind of side that can really frustrate a top of the table area team like Arsenal. And they come in and they pull this trick. I love it. I expect more of it in the future. And I think that's the attitude that they should have at the Emirates. That's the attitude that Arsenal fans all around the world should have, because that is a side. I know recent history hasn't exactly been kind to them, but there should be a sense of entitlement to that side and the way they play the game of football. And they have every reason to expect this from this team. And I think there's going to be a whole lot more of it. I love it. Go Wenger, go Gunners.
Did that really come from a Scouser fan's mouth?
Well, my father is an Arsenal supporter, so I have to. It bleeds down just a little bit.
Carter, what did you make of it? Because I mean, you're the voice of reason. I mean, is there any reason to get overly excited if you're an Arsenal fan after that?
Yeah, it seems like every time Ozil gets ripped in the British press, he steps up and has one of these performances. He was absolutely brilliant yesterday. And I thought Danny Welbeck answered his critics. I'm not one of his critics. I love the signing for Arsenal personally. But he had a great game. His movement was good. Arsenal can press high up the pitch with him in the side instead of Giroud. I thought they were very good. And I think that they answered a lot of people's questions about this side. Away from home in a very tough atmosphere against a side that was playing very well in Aston Villa. So, but Arsenal, then again, has these performances every now and then. But we always talk about their problems away from home in tough Premier League grounds. And this was a remarkable performance when you put that in context.
Yeah, super atmosphere at Villa for, 30-odd minutes. And then it kind of all went a bit pear-shaped, Bertie.
Yeah, no, I mean... It's unbelievable that you can score three goals in 3.5 minutes or whatever that was. Arsenal can do it. You know, I mean, the problem with Arsenal is that they don't have a back line, and they're going to get spanked. They're going to get spanked against the big teams. And against Dortmund, that's exactly what happened. What they didn't do during the transfer window is they just didn't buy some defenders. And it's all well and good having, midfield players and, attacking players. But it's going to be an up and down season for Arsenal. I mean, for them, it's going to be finishing the top four like every year, get to the semi-finals of the FA Cup, lose to Liverpool, whoever.
I'm liking these predictions. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, you're welcome. Which means that Liverpool's in the final and they lose to West Ham in the final.
Oh, I knew it had a happy ending for them.
Boys, final thoughts for the weekend. I'll start with you, Kartik. Wrap it all up for us in a nice little bow, and also... give me some social media info.
Ronald Koeman doing a wonderful job at Southampton. The special one parks the bus for 80 minutes and almost gets out of there with 3 points, but a good game there. And Manchester United, nothing has changed. Well, you can find me on Twitter at KKFLA737. Friend me on Facebook. Follow me on Google+. You'll find me on all the social media.
Go ahead, Matt.
It's the Premier League. Even when you think you know something, it turns out you don't know anything. Thank you, Leicester. Thank you, Frank Lampard. Thank you, really, all of Sunday. A lot of upsets, a lot of games where you kind of ended up shaking your head. And you can find me on Twitter, at MattsMusings1. You can send me hate mail there. And I know, because I'm a Tottenham supporter, I will get plenty of it.
Nate.
Three of Nick Webster's favorite words in the entire world: the table never lies. I know it's just five games in. Chelsea atop, Southampton in second, Leicester City in seventh, and then we wind down to the bottom half where we have Liverpool in 11th, Man United in 12th, and my favorite of all, the barcodes in the north, Newcastle in 20th place. Hit me up on Twitter at DarthNader99. It's been a real dark side weekend all over the footballing world for me, so hopefully cheer me up a little bit. Send me a happy tweet or friend me on Facebook, Nate Abareya.
Robin Burt, he's still in dreamland. Obviously, go on. Tell us how great West Ham was and how it made you all chubby and warm
inside.
They
are amazing. They're amazing. As long as West Ham keep winning and as long as Liverpool keep losing and as long as our hated neighbours down the road, Spurs, keep losing, it's going to be a fantastic season. And like the boys said, this weekend kept on giving, giving and giving. And I love it. You know, it may not be technically the best league of the world, but it's definitely one of the most exciting.
To echo that thought, Don and Bertie.
You can find me at Wes Sevenham, and troll me, people, troll me.
And to echo that thought, no doubt about it, the Premier League is the gift that just keeps on giving, and just when you expect and think that you have seen everything, something else comes along, and I just can't help but just sit here gleefully and look at that Manchester United scoreline again. Leicester 5, Leicester City 5, Manchester United 0. You can hit me up at Nick Webster or find me on Facebook. So thanks so much for joining us. Cheers, guys. And we will speak to you all next week. This has been the World Soccer Talk podcast.
Come on, you Irons.